This is the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. I'm Phil Picardi on this Wednesday, January 22nd. Coming up on the podcast, what could be the final effort to stop construction of a new Minneapolis stadium fails, progress in the Target data breach, or is it? A Minnesota senator promotes the kill switch, and it's time for new artwork at the state capitol, or is it? First, a second public hearing on a proposed copper-nickel mine will be held on Minnesota's Iron Range tonight. Elizabeth Dunbar reports.
The meeting in Aurora will be a chance for people who live closest to PolyMet's proposed mine and processing facility near Hoyt Lakes to comment. There has been strong local support for PolyMet. Labor unions are interested in the construction and mining jobs the company would bring to the area, and local officials are excited about the potential for an economic boost. But first, a 2,200-page environmental study on the project must pass muster. That study predicts long-term water treatment will be needed at both the mine and plant site to prevent pollutants from reaching the rivers and streams that are part of the Lake Superior watershed. The Department of Natural Resources is asking for feedback on that study during tonight's meeting. A third meeting is scheduled for next Tuesday in St. Paul, and the PolyMet public comment period is expected to conclude by mid-March. Elizabeth Dunbar, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Viking Stadium builders in Minneapolis say they are figuring out how to get financing for the project back on track. That after the state Supreme Court dismissed the final legal challenge to the funding plan. A pair of lawsuits threatened to set back construction. Tim Nelson has more.
Stadium opponent Doug Mann's plea to the Minnesota Supreme Court earlier this month was the legal equivalent of a Hail Mary pass, a last-minute, long-shot attempt to beat the Vikings in court. The former Minneapolis mayoral candidate sued twice to block stadium financing that includes millions of dollars in city sales taxes. But now that those challenges have fallen short, stadium builders are in hurry-up mode.
The construction bills that we're looking at by the end of the month are about $18 million.
That's Michelle Kelm-Helgen, chair of the Minnesota Sports Facilities Authority, the agency building the new stadium. The stadium authority expected to have nearly $500 million in hand by now, borrowed from investors that purchased stadium bonds. That would have been more than enough to buy a downtown east parking ramp by tomorrow and pay off bills for the new stadium work that's already started. But the court challenge halted the bond sale that the state was planning starting January 13th. And while the state's finance agency says the way is now clear to sell those bonds, Minnesota management and budget can't say when the bond deal will close and the money will be in the bank to pay stadium bills. So stadium builders are putting together a backup plan. Again, Michelle Kelm-Helgen.
We will not be closing on the downtown east property on Thursday. That certainly gives us money that can be applied to the construction bills.
Kelm-Helgen also says that her agency still has about $15 million in the bank. That's what's left of the $50 million down payment the Vikings had to put up last year to get the project started. That leaves the stadium authority just a few million dollars short. The plan is to pay the smaller businesses that are subcontractors on the project first and work out payment terms with Mortenson Construction, the general contractor in charge of building the new stadium. That also leaves another project up in the air. Downtown East is a $400 million mixed-use development planned for five blocks of Star Tribune land in downtown Minneapolis. That deal hinges on a new parking ramp the stadium authority wants to build. The ramp is planned next to two 18-story Wells Fargo office buildings and a two-block downtown park. The real estate deal was supposed to be done just after Christmas, but still hasn't closed. Ryan Companies is building that project. Vice President Rick Collins says the Supreme Court decision to strike down the stadium challenge helps clear the path.
It's great progress for the overall project. We have continued to work on a daily basis with the MSFA and the City of Minneapolis moving toward our closing on our purchase of the Star Tribune land, and we're getting very near to the date when we'll be able to do that.
That project schedule calls for a groundbreaking in April. Both Downtown East and the billion-dollar stadium are expected to be finished in 2016. For his part, stadium opponent Doug Mann says he is disappointed that his last-ditch court effort failed to stop the stadium. and he says he hasn't entirely given up. The Court of Appeals yesterday threw out the first stadium lawsuit he'd filed, and which he lost in Hennepin County District Court in November.
Well, I'm weighing my options.
But he concedes the odds are very long against him now for a second try at the Supreme Court.
I don't think it very likely that the Supreme Court will agree to review this. Spending the $550 might be, you know, just throwing money out the window.
In the meantime, work is still ongoing on the new stadium, and demolition crews were chipping away at the Metrodome with a wrecking ball yesterday.
That's Tim Nelson for us. Minneapolis-based Target will stop providing health care coverage to its part-time workers starting April 1st. Here's Elizabeth Stawicki.
Saying that the launch of the health insurance marketplaces provide new options for health care coverage, Target Human Resources Executive Vice President Jody Kozlak wrote in a blog post that Target will discontinue part-time health insurance coverage. She says less than 10%, or about 36,000 of the company's workforce, is enrolled in the plan for part-timers. The company also says offering part-timers insurance could actually make many of them ineligible for federal subsidies that could reduce the cost of insurance. Target will give U.S. employees who are losing coverage a $500 cash payment. The troubled retailer is reeling from a massive security breach that allowed cyber thieves to steal 40 million debit and credit card numbers and the name, email, and street addresses of 70 million customers. Elizabeth Stawicki, Minnesota Public Radio News.
There are conflicting reports about whether two Mexicans arrested in Texas had credit cards with account information stolen from Target. If so, it would be the first widely reported instance of data purloined from Target being used in fraudulent transactions. The two suspects face state charges after allegedly using the cards for purchases, totaling in the tens of thousands of dollars. Reporter Martin Moylan sorted out the conflicting reports with Tom Cran last night.
So who's saying what about this Target data theft in relation to these arrests and these cards?
Well, I talked with a department spokesman for the McAllen Police Department, and he says federal investigators told his department that cards these Mexicans used were part of the Target data breach. At least that's the understanding of the folks in the police department.
Right.
But the Secret Service isn't saying the cards are connected to the data breach. The Secret Service says it's working with the U.S. Attorney's Office and the police department down there to determine if there is a connection. It has not made that determination.
Now, what should we make of these conflicting reports from these two law enforcement agencies? They're working on the same case. Is one just being more cautious, maybe?
Someone doesn't have his story straight. There's nothing new there. It could be a misunderstanding. It happens all the time.
Now, could someone actually get card numbers that had been stolen from Target without any connection, that they themselves were not involved in the data scraping in any way?
Well, it's possible that the numbers on the cards in Texas could be among the card numbers that were stolen from Target, but maybe they were obtained in another way by mm-hmm. other crooks. That's not clear. But the numbers could have gotten out and in the hands of crooks, not as part of the data breach, but by some other means.
All right. So also they could have been maybe as part of the Neiman Marcus situation. Is that possible?
That's possible. But credit card numbers are stolen all the time. They can be grabbed by unscrupulous employees or merchants. Credit card numbers could be grabbed by someone taking your order online. People in a restaurant can use scanners to grab the account numbers and keep them by the hundreds or thousands, or they could just write the numbers down.
Yeah.
I spoke with a local security expert, Mark Lanterman, about this, and here's what he had to say.
Only time will tell, but yes, they certainly could have been attained some other way. Some other retailer may have been breached. There, I believe that it's premature to state this information is directly linked to the Target data breach.
So the odds would seem pretty good that some of the numbers hackers took from customers in Target stores could have also been stolen by crooks in another way. We're only talking about 100 or so cards down in Texas.
Yeah, the people who were arrested, according to the McAllen police, had, dozens of credit cards? But a stolen credit card number is a number, not the actual card itself. Can someone use somebody else's number and actually make a new card?
If you have the info, you can make the cards. Yeah. A complete setup would cost maybe $1,500. That'd get you a card reader, a card writer, a printer, and an embosser to put raised letters and numbers on the card. You can buy cards in bulk for about a dime each. Some even work with inkjet printers. You can buy the devices on Amazon.com and elsewhere online, even direct from the manufacturers. They have legitimate uses, but people are able to buy them and put them to illegal uses.
And they can make them look just like somebody else's credit card, official Visa cards, whatever.
Yeah, they can dress them up, or in some cases they just use them plain white cards, swipe them at gas pumps and other places where people don't look.
All right, Martin Moylan, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Moylan, Cran on All Things Considered and the NPR News Update. Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar is planning to introduce legislation that requires so-called kill switches in smartphones. She says the ability to remotely disable a stolen phone would both deter theft and protect users. The measure has the support of law enforcement, especially at the University of Minnesota, where there's been an uptick in smartphone theft. But as Matt Sepik reports, critics say such technology won't work and could have some bad consequences.
University of Minnesota's senior Billy Black has had a bad run of luck with cell phones lately. Last summer, he left one outside a friend's apartment. It was long gone by the time he returned. A few weeks later, Black says he was at a party near campus. As things were winding down, he set smartphone number 2 on a table by the couch and crashed for the night. He woke up to find his iPhone had gone home with someone else. Black says he dialed his number but got nowhere.
Never answered any of the calls when I called them, and eventually just, I guess, turned it off or something.
Black says the 2 lost iPhones set him back more than $300, and with his carrier not willing to track the devices or give him a break on his contract, he's now doing the technological equivalent of couch surfing. From a borrowed Android phone, Black says Senator Amy Klobuchar may be onto something with her idea for a mandatory cell phone kill switch.
Given my history with that, it doesn't seem like a bad idea to mandate something like that. I don't see much of a downside to it. I can see how people might claim that, you know, it's an invasion of privacy or something like that. But if you use any sort of app or really use your phone, period, I feel like they can figure out where you are.
Klobuchar gave an overview of her proposed legislation at a news conference yesterday at the U. While many details have yet to be worked out, Klobuchar insisted her bill is not meant to expand government snooping, nor will it, she says, because authorities won't have the ability to target individual users.
The government wouldn't be shutting off the phone. The individual, it's giving the individual the ability to shut off the phone, just as a lot of the iPhones have right now. That's all it's doing. It's not saying the government will shut down the phone. It's saying that the individual owner can shut down the phone.
If you have an iPhone running the latest operating system called iOS 7, you can remotely disable the device as long as you set up the Find My iPhone app ahead of time. But with other smartphone brands growing in popularity, Klobuchar says the kill switch needs to be more widely available. Minneapolis Police Chief Janae Harto agrees. She says a cell phone is taken in 1 out of every 3 armed robberies, a statistic that was borne out on and near the University of Minnesota campus last fall. That part of the city saw a 27% uptick in robberies over the 5-year average. Harto says police can only provide part of the solution.
We're going to continue to do enforcement. We're going to continue to educate. But to really have an impact on public safety, this has to be a collaborative effort. And we need the manufacturers and the cell phone companies to be at the table.
The cell phone industry says it's doing its part to combat theft. A lobbying group called CTIA, the Wireless Association, says it's already setting up databases of stolen phones so carriers can prevent those phones from being reactivated. Kill switch supporters say that won't stop overseas buyers from reactivating the phones, but CTIA opposes mandatory kill switches. The group says the technology could easily be exploited. Anton Schieffer explains how that could happen. Schieffer works at a computer forensics company in Minneapolis and blogs about tech issues. He says black hat hackers could spoof a kill switch signal and wipe out a lot of phones with just the click of a mouse.
I feel like with a lot of legislation regarding cell phones, legislators are usually well-intentioned, but sometimes these bills can have unintended consequences, and I think that's the case in this scenario.
Schieffer says kill switches could also put the brakes on the legitimate market for used cell phones if buyers fear that their devices could be disabled by a previous owner. Schieffer's advice for avoiding theft: pay attention to your surroundings when you're using your phone and don't get too wrapped up in that game of Candy Crush.
Matt Sepik there in Minneapolis. Candy Crush aside, the latest Minnesota student survey shows young people are taking part in fewer risky behaviors than in the past. Tim Post reports.
160,000 students took the survey last year, and the results show fewer of them are smoking, drinking, and taking drugs. That's a trend that the Minnesota Department of Education's Sheila Orline says has continued over the last decade.
Kids in Minnesota are doing pretty well, and over time they've been getting better.
The latest survey also asked detailed questions about bullying. As many as 12% of students report being bullied over race or sexual orientation. One in four students say they faced bullying over their weight or appearance. Tim Post, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The mayors of Minneapolis and St. Paul plan to focus on early childhood development as a way to improve education in minority communities. Here's our Curtis Gilbert.
Research shows that by the time a poor child reaches age 3, he'll have heard 30 million fewer words than a child from a more wealthy family. St. Paul Mayor Chris Coleman says that word gap causes problems that can continue throughout that child's education.
So that when they get to kindergarten, their vocabulary skills are so weak that for the rest of that child's education, it seems like you're doing remedial work for what happened in the first couple of years of the child's life.
Coleman says the answer can be as simple as reminding expectant mothers to read to their children. Minneapolis Mayor Betsy Hodges agrees. She wants to expand a city program called Healthy Starts,
which are visits with pregnant moms that continue with those families for the first couple years of life to really make sure that kids are getting that start.
Hodges and Coleman have both pledged to reduce racial disparities in their cities. Curtis Gilbert, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Governor Mark Dayton returned to the Mayo Clinic in Rochester today to discuss a remedy for lingering problems with his hip. Dayton injured that hip last summer and later underwent a medical procedure. Dayton says he's having trouble with stability, but not pain. He also says it won't slow down his reelection campaign this year.
I don't intend to. I mean, I don't love to see what my physical capability. I may not be able to run down the parade routes and shake every hand, but, you know, we'll have to deal with that. But last time I looked, brain cells are not, don't gather in the hip.
Dayton says the stability problem is also related to the back surgery he had a year ago. Governor Dayton says it might be time to declare the Civil War over, at least when it comes to the artwork at the state capitol building. Dayton is not a fan of much of the building's current artwork, and he says the future of those paintings should be discussed as part of the Capitol renovation project that's underway. Here's Tim Pugmire.
During a meeting of the Capitol Preservation Commission, Governor Dayton noted the artwork on the walls around him. The historic governor's reception room has four large paintings that depict Civil War battles where Minnesota soldiers fought and died. There's even more Civil War art in various locations throughout the Capitol, and Dayton is wondering if it might be too much.
They're historically significant. Do they represent the whole complexion of Minnesota? And, you know, how does the art here fit into the art in the newly renovated state capitol? This is a discussion we just sort of started today, but we will have and need to have so that we can just come to a consensus about, you know, what best represents Minnesota.
DFL Representative Diane Loeffler of Minneapolis raised similar questions during the meeting. Loeffler said she thinks there are enough paintings of battles and victims. She said the Capitol needs a better balance of artwork.
I just think that there's more to our story of our state and its accomplishments than the roles that we've played in military conflicts, and we need to add that to our story as well.
Civil War memories were still fresh in many Minnesotans' minds when the state capitol opened in 1905. Republican Representative Dean Erdahl of Grove City, a former history teacher, said the Capitol was built as a monument to Civil War veterans and should remain that way.
Those who built this Capitol either had been involved in the Civil War themselves or had very near relatives who were, and so remembering the Civil War is reflected in the artwork of this building, and I think that's important.
Erdahl said the Civil War paintings should be restored, not replaced. He said the renovation of the building will open some areas where other types of artwork could be added. Governor Dayton also questioned the tradition of hanging portraits of former governors along the hallways of the Capitol. So far, all the state's governors have been white males. Dayton said he doesn't see the relevance of the portraits.
You could fit them all into it. Maybe there's a place downstairs or somewhere, you know, a wall or whatever. Or maybe you take one every tenth one just to show the historical, the changes in how people dressed and appeared. But to me, this entire space should be about Minnesota and all of its elements and its increasing diversity.
State historians will have the final say on the artwork, and changes appear unlikely given their mandate to remain true to the vision of architect Cass Gilbert. Brian Peace, historic site manager for the Minnesota Historical Society, said much of the art in question has been in place since the Capitol opened.
All of the murals you'll see within the public spaces, they're actually canvases fixed to the walls. And so that's all part of the original Cass Gilbert plan. With the Beaux-Arts style building, which this is, the idea was you incorporate art and architecture in the same location, the same spaces.
P said the tradition of hanging portraits of former governors along hallways didn't begin until 1944. He said the current configuration of portraits will need to change when several original light fixtures are returned to the interior walls during the building renovation. All the fixes are expected to be done by the end of 2016. Tim Pugmire, Minnesota Public Radio News at the Capitol.
Now we ride into the sunset on a bicycle. A long-range plan from the city of St. Paul includes a proposal to more than double the size of the city's bike lane network. The city currently has about 140 miles of bike trails and lanes. The proposal would expand that to more than 350 miles. The plan also proposes a nearly 2-mile bicycle loop in downtown St. Paul that would cost about $18 million. City planner Reuben Collins says a major goal is to encourage more city residents to ride bikes.
I think one thing that this plan really strives to do is to recognize that the existing bikeway network may only appeal to a small portion of the residents in the city, but if we had a better network, we might be able to expand that appeal and capture some people who would really like to ride a bicycle but don't currently because they don't feel safe doing so.
Reuben says biking becomes safer when more cyclists are on the road. A final version of the plan, expected in June, will include possible funding sources for expanding the city's bicycle network. That's it for the NPR News Update on Wednesday, 1-22-14. Phil Picardi here, glad you came along. The Thursday news right back here tomorrow.